Good morning, everyone. It's truly a pleasure to be here in snowy Halifax in this beautiful facility. I've really been enjoying my stay in Canada despite the winter weather, or maybe because of the winter weather. It's very nice to experience. And thank you very much, Rasa. It is a real pleasure to be with you today here. I really did enjoy our conversation when you visited my office in September, and thank you for the intensive work you've undertaken over these months of your presidency. Really appreciate that very much. You know, for over 60 years, the NATO Parliamentary Assembly has provided an essential link between the NATO headquarters in Brussels and the people our alliance exists to protect. The first duty of any government is the security of its citizens. As elected representatives, you play a central role in holding your governments to account, holding their feet to the fire when it comes to the money they spend and the actions they take, actions which, when it comes to security, often center on the NATO alliance. You also act as our promoters in chief with your public, fostering public understanding and support for our alliance. And to me, that is one of the most important functions of national legislatures, national parliaments, to form connective tissue for us at NATO headquarters and for all the troops who serve NATO with your public. So I thank you very much for that role. In the age of active disinformation campaigns, this is more important than ever, and so I know we all have to be alert to the burgeoning of disinformation campaigns, but I thank you again very much for helping the publics to understand what is fact and what is disinformation. This month, in ceremonies around the world, we have been remembering the fallen from the First World War and all wars and conflicts since then. I myself was in Brussels to mark the armistice last week, at a ceremony led by the King of Belgium to honor those who had made the ultimate sacrifice. Those men and women came not just from Europe, but from all over the world. Thousands of American and Canadian soldiers found their final resting place in Flanders Fields, a place immortalized by the Canadian poet John McCrae. We honored them at the armistice ceremonies. What touched me most about that ceremony in Brussels, however, was the children involved. Children of all ages, from the scouts, from the guides, from the military schools in Belgium. Some spoke beautifully, truly beautifully, about remembrance. It is important that the young are learning how to remember. And I really took that away as the main lesson of that ceremony, that the young of Belgium are learning to remember. Sadly, the Great War was not the war to end all wars 100 years ago. Little more than two decades later, the lure of nationalism and hatred led us to another devastating global conflict in which millions more lost their lives. In the years after World War II, our leaders sought a new way, a better way of conducting international relations. They came together to reshape our world with multilateral institutions, such as the United Nations and also NATO, institutions that unified our nations in the pursuit of peace. Human nature may mean there will always be disagreement, but that doesn't mean we must accept that war is inevitable. Unity among allies has underpinned our security since NATO's beginning. For nearly seven decades, the United States, Canada, and Europe have depended on each other. A stronger, safer, more prosperous Europe means a stronger, safer, and more prosperous North America. Of course, in some ways, the bonds that unite us are under strain. There are significant differences of opinion over issues of trade, climate change, and the Iran nuclear deal. These disagreements will not vanish overnight, and there may be others to come as well. But differences of view are normal among friends and allies. I always think of NATO as one big family, and families often have disputes, but it doesn't mean that the family dissipates or disappears. We have had our share of disagreements in NATO across its 70-year history. The Suez crisis in the 1950s put a great strain on the alliance. France, actually left the command structure in the 1960s, meaning that we moved from Paris to Brussels. And more recently, there was the Iraq War in 2003. Despite all these differences, despite all these strains, however, when it came to the crunch, when it came to our commitment to stand together, protect each other, we remain united. It is clearly in our interest for Europe and North America to stand together today. That is why young Canadian and American soldiers fought in the Western Front in World War I, and why so many of their sons later fought their way across the beaches of Normandy. And it is why hundreds of thousands of European troops fought side by side with their North American brothers and sisters in Afghanistan following the attacks on 9/11. We saw this unity of action once again last month in the biggest NATO exercise since the end of the Cold War. The minister already referred to it in his remarks a few moments ago. Trident Juncture brought together 50,000 troops from all 29 NATO allies, plus Finland and Sweden, brought them all to Norway. Nearly half of them came from across the Atlantic. As I saw for myself, it was a huge logistical undertaking and a real test of our military mobility and interoperability. It was a test, in my view, that we passed. Still got more work to do, but clearly the alliance passed the test. Let me give you one example of that interoperability. I really love it. German tanks arrived in Norway on a Danish vessel. They were checked by Norwegian specialists, fueled by a Belgian fuel truck, and loaded on Dutch and Polish transporters by road and rail and taken to their final destination, all of which was supervised by an American movement control team and overseen by Bulgarian logisticians. Now that, to me, is interoperability and cooperation across the alliance. Really a terrific example. When I was there at Trident Juncture, I spoke to a French CBRN team. They told me about what we would need to do if we were to come into contact with chemical, biological, or radiological weapons. The protection, the mitigation, the cleanup, all of these steps were things that they had well in hand. Now that we have seen chemical weapons being used in Syria, sadly, and in the UK, it was good to know that NATO teams are practicing what would need to happen if our troops encountered such threats. I also spoke with the Modular Combined Petroleum Unit, part of the refueling team. This unit is where the rubber really hits the road in terms of interoperability. They were telling me about the different sized hoses they need for different vehicles, quite extensive, as you can imagine, and the challenges of having to deal with both the metric system and, for one ally who shall remain nameless, the imperial system. But they were up to the job. They had what they needed, and they were taking care of all the differences in order to ensure interoperability. It was really impressive. I really got a lot out of being there for the Distinguished Visitors Day. So I want to pay tribute right now to all the capable men and women who worked so hard to move all the forces and equipment in and around Norway for Trident Juncture. They made the exercise a success. Trident Juncture demonstrated the increasing capabilities of our armed forces. Defense budgets across the alliance have risen every year for the past 4 years. Together, European nations and Canada have been responsible for an additional $87 billion for defense spending since 2014. Despite all the evident debates in the media, I am very much heartened by renewed efforts to strengthen European defense. If properly implemented, improvements and expansion in European defense spending can benefit Europe as well as NATO overall. Such expenditures can mean greater European defense spending and stronger European capabilities, and they can contribute to better transatlantic burden sharing. I want to repeat that again. European expenditures on defense, there's no reason why they cannot contribute to better burden sharing inside of NATO. A stronger Europe means a stronger NATO, but it is important that all of this remain within the framework of the transatlantic alliance. Our exercise, Trident Juncture, also sent a very clear message to all who may think to challenge the alliance. NATO stands ready to defend all of the allies against any threat. This is an important message as we deal with a more challenging and complex security environment. International terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and of course, an increasingly aggressive Russia. Russia has illegally annexed Crimea. It continues to actively destabilize eastern Ukraine, where more than 10,000 people have lost their lives since 2014. Russia has used a military-grade nerve agent on the streets of the United Kingdom. They initiate a constant barrage of cyber attacks, and they interfere in our elections and in our domestic affairs. In addition, they have also undergone a vast expansion and modernization of their military. One particularly worrying aspect of this is the rearmament effort, is their new intermediate-range missile, the 9M729, or in NATO parlance, the SSC-8, which is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead to the heart of Europe in minutes. This directly undermines one of the most important arms control treaties of the Cold War, the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF. When it was signed by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987, it not only reduced the number of nuclear missiles held by both superpowers, it eliminated an entire class of weapons. The INF treaty made Europe and the world a much safer place. Allies first raised concerns that Russia might be in violation of the INF treaty in 2013. At the time, Russia categorically denied developing a new missile. Now they have finally admitted that it does exist. And this new weapon system has placed the INF treaty at serious risk. If a treaty is only respected by one party, it cannot effectively keep us safe. As this issue is debated, I ask you to remember one thing. There are no new U.S. missiles in Europe of intermediate range. But there are new Russian missiles in Europe of intermediate range capable of carrying nuclear warheads. NATO has repeatedly urged Russia to address our concerns and to ensure it is in full compliance of the INF Treaty. Nobody in this room wants a new arms race or a Cold War. Now is the time for dialogue, but it is also time for action by Russia to allay our very serious concerns. It is vital that when NATO talks, we do so with one voice and from a position of strength. Our NATO summit in July was a strong affirmation of an alliance that delivers. It delivers in achieving fairer burden sharing. It delivers in stepping up the fight against terrorism. It delivers in strengthening our deterrence and defense, reaching out to partner countries and organizations. And it delivers in keeping our doors open to new members. But the work continues. At our meeting of foreign ministers in December, we will discuss a whole range of important subjects. We will discuss transatlantic security, including burden sharing, and the challenge posed by Russia, including the threat to the INF Treaty. We will meet with our partners in the Resolute Support Mission on Afghanistan, and we will also discuss the strategic threat coming from instability in North Africa and the Middle East. We will discuss NATO's new Canadian-led training mission in Iraq, and here I want to express my sincere appreciation for Canada again stepping forward to take over the command of this important new NATO mission. Also, the implications to our mission of the recent elections there. And we will discuss what NATO can do to strengthen the Libyan state. Another focus of the ministerial will be the Western Balkans. A lot is happening in the Western Balkans at this moment. Progress on the name agreement between Skopje and Athens opens the way toward NATO membership. But there are continuing tensions elsewhere in the region, and we see increasing levels of Russian interference. We have had relative stability and calm in the Western Balkans for almost 20 years now. It is important to NATO and for European security that that continues. Ladies and gentlemen, next year, we will celebrate the 70th anniversary of the signing in 1949 of the Washington Treaty, NATO's founding document. We will also mark the enlargement of our alliance by over a dozen countries of Central Europe in 1999, in 2004, and in 2009. These anniversaries will be an opportunity to cement in the eyes of our public the urgent need for the NATO alliance, not as a Cold War relic, not as something that's outdated, but as an anchor of stability and an essential tool for the security of all of our nations. In this, we will need your full support, your support for NATO within your parliaments, within budget discussions, and with your publics will make a big difference. There is nothing stronger than this alliance when it is united and when our publics are behind it. In that, your support is essential. Thank you very much for your attention, and I do look forward to our question and answer period. I'm going to sit down so I can more easily take note of the questions asked me, and I'll do the best I can to answer your questions. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Rose, for your remarks. And now we come to questions. Please be seated. Philippe Folliot, France. Or maybe we will group into three questions, okay? So next will be Julia Miranda Calha from Portugal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to thank you for coming all the way here to Halifax to answer the questions from NATO PA. I would like to thank our Canadian friends for organizing all this. My question on behalf of the French delegation is with regards to Sahel, this vast space with very little population for now, but it is a very dynamic region when it comes to its demography. And this region has been experiencing terrorism for a number of years now. It is Islamist terrorism, and we also see a drug and human trafficking in that region. The GSM, the special group on the Middle East and the Mediterranean that I chair, has been studying this for a while. We started looking at the issue in 2007. It was just beginning then. And now it's a real security issue. And so there was the creation of an alliance on Sahel to develop a program that gets assistance from the EU and a number of its member states, such as Italy, Spain, Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, France, and others. Madam Secretary General, I would like to know if NATO thinks that Sahel is a main element when it comes to its security, and I would like to know how the alliance wants to analyze what is being done by G5 Sahel. And I would like to ask you whether NATO would provide additional expertise if necessary to the military action underway right now. Thank you.
Thanks. Julia Miranda Calha from Portugal. And the next will be Lord Jobling from UK.
Thank you very much, President. Dear Deputy Secretary General, it was a very good exposition you made to us, and I'm grateful for that presentation. My question is, the hub for the South was declared fully operational at the Brussels summit. Is the hub fully resources now, or are there still any shortfalls that NATO allies should fill? This is my question, and I profit this opportunity to make a reference to our President of the Assembly, Mrs. Raza Yuknevichian. She was a great president. She is a great reference in our Assembly. And I am very honored to have her presidency. Thank you, Raza, to be with us. Thank you for your work and merit and fair play. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia. Lord Jobling, UK.
Deputy Secretary General, you are aware, I know, that the International Board of Auditors for NATO have made serious reservations about the way NATO controls its financial affairs. I have twice asked the Secretary General to comment on those reservations, and twice I have had no answer whatsoever from him in a way which I can only describe as dismissive. I can only assume that either he didn't know or he didn't care about these important reservations. and both of those would be and are unacceptable. But by contrast, you kindly have sent me in the last few days a four-page letter answering those reservations. And I want to take this opportunity warmly to thank you for the response which you have made. Now, if I may turn to what is the classic role of parliamentarians in checking the executive and asking questions and demanding answers, perhaps I can ask you a question following your letter. Can I take it that NATO intends to pursue the establishment of genuinely independent audit committees at the level of governing bodies compliant with international standards and best practices on governance? That is, if I can put it briefly, there'd be committees not only made up of nations' representatives, but also including recognised professional independent experts. Can I have a simple yes to that, if you please?
The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I will take the questions in order. Thank you very much for all of the questions. Very thoughtful, as I've come to discover in this body, and extremely well informed. First of all, to our French colleague, NATO has been watching with close interest what is going on in the Sahel region. It is, I think, worth pointing out that there is, I would say, a focus in NATO on working with our Mediterranean dialogue partners in the North African part of the Mediterranean, but here our Mauritanian partner in the Mediterranean dialogue, NATO's body, have asked us to look at what is going on with the G5 Sahel and consider being engaged there, as well as the G5 Sahel, France itself, and other countries who have been operating in the context of the G5 Sahel. So it is a request we have seen. I do want to underscore an important point, though, and that is that NATO cannot and does not do everything when it comes to instability in this part of the world or any place else. I always, and here I'll make reference to the cooperation with the European Union, who has very much been focused on strengthening border controls, on developing at least the kernel of economic assistance and cooperative programs to develop the potential for more economic health and prosperity developing in the region to begin to address the major problems that ignite the problems that then come to dog Europe in terms of uncontrolled migration and issues of that kind, human smuggling. So I always like to say that there are several toolkits out there. The European Union has one toolkit, particularly focused, again, in part on defense, on military activities, but also focused very much on assistance, on financial and development aid. NATO has a different toolkit. We don't do everything, and we won't do everything. So the question is, can we effectively bring our toolkits together and form a single, very effective toolbox? I like to think the answer is yes to that question, and we are increasingly developing our cooperation with the European Union in order to be able to do that. Whether or not we will come to exercise those cooperative efforts in the G5 Sahel region, I cannot tell you, sir. It's always a decision for NATO allies as a whole. It must be a consensus decision for NATO to become more engaged in that region. But we will continue to work with our Mediterranean dialogue partners in every way we can to facilitate an enhancement to security in that region of the world. The Portuguese question with regard to the Hub for the South, and indeed very, very glad to see it declared fully operational at our NATO summit in July. Frankly, we do continue to experience shortfalls in terms of
Manning. We are looking particularly to focus on developing more civilian expertise at the hub to back up the military expertise, very capable military expertise already existing there. But the hub, the idea of the hub is to really help NATO have more over-the-horizon capability to see threats before they come at us. And so for that, we need not only very capable military expertise, but also civilian experts. So that is what we are focusing on now. But the hub is getting off to a very good start, and we've been very, very pleased to have that new capability and new potential developing. Lord Joplin, thank you very much. I will say, and I do want to emphasize, as I should have said earlier today, that the Secretary General very much values his interactions with this body. He was very sorry he could not be here to meet with you today. I just mentioned the EU. The EU foreign ministerial is going on in these days, and so he is present at the ministerial. But he asked me to convey his very best wishes to you. And I want to say, sir, that I was responding on behalf of the Secretary General as his deputy, of course. I don't do anything unless it's at his request and in response to the concerns that have been raised in general by you, both with him and with me, over time. So I cannot give you a simple yes or no to your question because I don't know enough about exactly what we are doing in-house on this issue. Again, I will take the question and get you an answer. I can confirm that. I will say, and I wanted to point out, that we are working hard to implement NATO financial regulations across the body now in our agencies as well as in the NATO institution per se. And I hope, Sir Lord Joplin, it will give you some positive feeling that whereas in the past we have had less than half of our audits come in without questions being asked. This year, the number of audits that have come in without question being asked, it's at 70%. So we are improving, and we will do everything we can to continue to do so. But I will take your question, sir, and get you an answer.
Thank you. Ricard Terno, Spain. And the next will be colleague from Norway, Christian. Spain, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I will speak in Spanish.
First of all, Ms. Madame Gautemiller, I would like to thank you for your presence among us, and I'd like to thank the Canadian delegation for making us feel so welcome, even though it's a little cold. In these past few days in Halifax, I've seen that for some members of the Assembly, the common security and defense policy of the EU is a threat for NATO. That's the way it is perceived by them. However, for us, it's not about competing, it's about coordinating a European defense policy. There are problems that we need to resolve on our own. Even our allies ask that we resolve them on our own. An example would be the Sahel. You just replied to the representative from the French delegation and said that there are things that NATO cannot do. We can't ignore that in North Africa there is a serious migration crisis, a serious economic crisis, where the presence of terrorist forces threaten the NATO countries, and it would be a mistake to ignore that. Do you think that the national model of integration is a threat to NATO, as some parliamentarians are implying at this assembly? Do you think the industrial and budgetary strengthening in defense in EU countries not only is not a threat, but will significantly improve NATO's capabilities and is beneficial to all allies? Thank you very much.
Christian Tybring Gjedde, Norway. And the next speaker will be from Iceland, Daniel Fridbergsson.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Secretary. We will share the question between the two of us here in the Norwegian delegation. I just wanted to thank all NATO allies for participating in the joint juncture exercise in Norway, the recent exercise. And the exercise shows that the alliance stand together. It was a great opportunity to show cooperability and show that we are building a teamwork and it's a solidarity between the alliance. So Norway thank all the members for that. My very short question before I leave the floor to my colleague here, it's just about the recent accident we had with the Norwegian frigate. I guess you all heard of it. And I just wonder, we lost one of five frigates that we have. And I just wonder what NATO, how NATO is involved in this, not in the investigation, but how they are in contact with the Norwegian government in order to maybe look at the accident. Thank you. And then Liv Signe.
Njal, floor is yours. Iceland.
One more question. We have a question from Norway here to my colleague. That's why we share the 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. My question is about the relevance of NATO's Article 5 to so-called hybrid warfare, understood as warfare using non-military unconventional means in addition to the conventional ones. In Ukraine, during the past 4 years, one has seen massive cyber attacks, for instance, against the country's electrical power system and emergence of paramilitary groups. If such attacks were to be directed against a NATO member country, where would the alliance, in your view, draw the line for triggering Article 5? And if I may, could you also comment upon the Northern Sea Route along Russia's northern coast that will likely to be open for year-round passage within the next 20 years? What, in your view, will this imply for NATO and the alliance member countries? As we know, that China and Russia now has an ongoing maritime cooperation, and that will be, of course, a very short route when this sea route will open. Thank you very much.
Iceland, Njal, floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you, Mrs. Deputy Secretary General. We are all aware that the High North is becoming increasingly important in its strategic, security and economic dimensions. Arctic ice levels are decreasing rapidly and such changes are affecting traditional ways of life. Also, there are growing opportunities for commercial shipping, resource extraction, tourism and fishing. However, as the commercial importance of the region grows and with geopolitical changes in the region, there are fears of increasing tensions between the countries with littoral Arctic waters. Furthermore, Russia has put increased focus on militarization of the region. In the light of these recent geopolitical developments, as well as the fact that five members of the alliance have territory in the region, do you see NATO's role in the High North increasing and will its attention on the security aspects become greater? Thank you.
Thank you very much for those excellent questions. Some of them can be grouped together, talking about what's going on in the High North. I will say a big thank you to Norway for hosting Trident Juncture. It was a massive, massive effort. And again, seeing I was in Trondheim and recognizing, you know, how much the local publics were welcoming the exercise units, despite the fact that it was a lot of traffic on the roads and a lot of presence there. But nevertheless, I do know that the Norwegian public was extremely, extremely welcoming. So we're very, very grateful for that. We are, of course, aware of the recent accident involving the Norwegian frigate. Of course, my boss, Sec. Jens Stoltenberg, from Norway, very, very aware, obviously, and expressing his concern about it. But we're all very glad that that the accident occurred and did not result in loss of life. That was really quite an amazing, I think, rescue effort in the wake of the accident. It will be, of course, up to Norway to carry out the investigation. NATO is not directly involved in the investigation, but we are interested, of course, in knowing what the results of the investigation are. Let me take the other questions that are related to the North and the Northern Sea Route together at this moment. Of course, there are indeed greater opportunities for economic activity in the far north as the ice melts, and clearly we can see that there's great interest not only in Russia developing the Northern Sea Route for commercial purposes. It can, of course, be of, and it will be of great benefit for global commerce if that sea route can be developed in a safe and effective manner. And indeed, China is very interested as a global commerce giant. China is very interested in cheaper ways to ship goods from Asia to the other parts of the globe. So all of this is very understandable. But I think from a NATO perspective, what concerns us is greater militarization in the far north. And we have seen the Russian Federation modernizing its military facilities in the high north, much more present with ships, submarines. And it's meant for NATO that we have truly had to again intensify our attention to very important areas of military activity like anti-submarine warfare. And I want to give credit to Iceland here for being very engaged and involved in our ASW training and exercises recently. The Dynamic Mongoose exercise last year was a very good example of how the alliance is again turning its attention to ASW and emphasizing again both the training and the exercises, but also thinking about the new capabilities that will be required. And here I'd like to give a shout out to our Canadian hosts in their investments, putting a lot of investment into ice-capable ships. Just in recent days, an ice-capable patrol ship, the DeWolf, was launched. Very, very good. And in icebreakers as well. So all of this means for NATO, talking about the NATO alliance, all of this means that we have to pay attention to training, to exercises. That's why I think it was great we had Trident Juncture up in the high north. It was a wake-up call for some allies who aren't used to exercising and training in very cold winter conditions. So we need to be doing more of that. We need to be focusing on the particular challenges that will come as there's greater submarine activity and greater maritime and naval activity overall by the Russian Federation in the high north. So a lot of work to be done. I feel good that we've had that wake-up call. We're focusing on what's needed. We're looking at ways to intensify training in the high north, but also looking at ways to acquire the capabilities we need. But here again, and one final point that I think is important, because the members of the alliance who are focused in polar regions, have are bordering on the polar regions, are also members of the NATO Council. I'm sorry, of the Arctic Council. Here again, NATO doesn't do everything. The Arctic Council focuses very much on important efforts such as emergency response, search and rescue, all of these non-military arenas that are very important also for ensuring that the polar regions remain an area for cooperation and not for confrontation. So NATO's not involved in the Arctic Council. It won't be involved in the Arctic Council, but the two organizations have different roles, but nevertheless, both are very, very important. And from NATO's perspective, of course, what we want to see is a peaceful Arctic where trade and economic activities can develop in a peaceful and cooperative way. Now, on to the question about influence or the relevance of Article 5 to hybrid measures and cyber measures. This is an area where the alliance has paid a lot of attention in recent years. At the Warsaw Summit in 2016, for the first time, NATO declared that cyber attacks are relevant to Article 5. In other words, an ally can invoke Article 5 in response to a cyber attack. It's the same at our summit this summer in Brussels with regard to hybrid measures. And hybrid and cyber, sometimes, you know, people talk about them together, but I think it's worth noting that hybrid is a larger category, that it can include everything from disinformation attacks using all kinds of methods and platforms to the notion of little green men irregular forces attacking a country. So it's very, very important, I think, to bear in mind that the alliance is looking at this set of threats in association with Article 5 and stating clearly that for potential adversaries, they should have a wake-up call that indeed if they go after NATO countries with these kinds of attacks, indeed they are risking Article 5 being invoked. But there are two important points about this. First, it's a deterrence measure. Having that kind of declaratory doctrine is an important deterrence measure, in my view. But the second thing is, then we have work to do inside the alliance to ensure that we are ready to respond if that invocation occurs. And that means we have to think carefully through what the range of responses might be. It's not necessary, or not necessarily so, that the alliance would respond to a cyber attack with a cyber response. That's a possibility. We have been agreeing about cyber effects being made available by certain of our allies in that eventuality. But it's also very important to think about other response measures that may be taken across the spectrum of tools that are available to NATO. So we have to think those steps through carefully. And then we also have to think about measures of resilience among all the allies and helping the allies to develop resilience against such attacks, and furthermore then to be able to identify such attacks, and most importantly to identify who perpetrated such attacks. Oftentimes, it is said in NATO circles, and of course I agree with this, that it's a national responsibility in the end to do the forensics, to do the identification. We agree with that, of course, at NATO headquarters, but that does not mean that NATO cannot help all allies to understand the complexities of forensics and to understand what their responsibilities are in that regard. So there are a lot of very, very complicated issues here, but I am very confident coming out of Warsaw and Brussels, the two summit meetings over the last 2 years, that in fact we are thinking very, very hard about how to confront these steps, these kinds of threats, and indeed thinking through our responsibility to be able to respond to a threat of attack in a number of different ways, including and up to the invocation of Article 5.
Thank you. Now, next three questions in group. First one, Greece, Andreas Loverdos. The second one, Lithuania, Juozas Olekas.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam President. My remarks concern NATO's orientations. As my country is situated in the southeastern Europe, in the Balkans, we Greeks can easily realize what exactly the Russian threats are. However, I share the opinion that our alliance gives less importance to the threats coming from the south. First of all, terrorism, drugs, migrants, smuggling have been mentioned many times in the recent joint declaration of Europe and NATO. But actually, as a matter of fact, as alliance, we are underestimating the gravity of these threats, the gravity of these dangers for all our countries. I believe we must do more to this direction, and I am asking from you, Madam Deputy Secretary General, for your comments. Thank you very much.
Juozas Olekas, Lithuania, and next Belgium, Brigitte Grevels. Juozas, floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. First of all, I would like to thank Deputy General Secretary for a very informative, impressive, and interesting statement. I strongly agree and believe that you said that our strength and power is in the political unity and military interoperability. especially in this very challenging time when we mentioned hybrid cyber threats, terrorists, and Russia activities. My question is about our partners, relation with our partners. In our committee meetings, we discussed in this assembly also about the Georgia, Ukraine, and we welcoming Georgia engagement in strategic discussion and mutual effortness on Black Sea security, Georgia contribution to NATO efforts to enhance Black Sea security. We also support and many countries formalize the training of Ukraine military forces, and we know about the goal of Ukraine to reach NATO standards in 2020. And keeping all that in mind, and keeping in mind our open door policy, and also that a lot of efforts Ukraine and Georgia doing to reach the standards. And also what our president of assembly said, that Ukrainians, they soldiers fight not only for them freedom, but also for our values. But we as allies and our parliament assembly can do more that this our door open policy and Ukraine and Georgia activities have reached a success. Thank you.
Belgium, Brigitte, floor is yours.
Thank you, Mrs. Deputy General, Secretary General. Thank you for your introduction. Thank you also to the Canadian delegation for an excellent organization and reception. Thank also to Raza, being an excellent, warm-hearted president. Mrs. Deputy Secretary General, the worst threats from hybrid tactics coming from Russia is probably influencing the hearts and minds of our own population through clever propaganda, fake news, lies, with the aim to break the transatlantic unity of NATO, to break Canada and the United States away from solidarity with Europe, telling that NATO commitments cost too much, financing certain opinion makers or other things could lower support of our population to NATO. Is this, at this moment, considered as a realistic threat? And what is the answer of NATO to this? Thank you.
Thank you very much to our Greek colleague for his question. Actually, this is another fine example, I think. First of all, NATO is very committed in our framework for the South. I've talked already today about the hub for the South and what we have done to bring it to full operational capability and the additional resources, especially in terms of civilian expertise we're looking for there. But the framework for the South has been a very important mechanism to focus the attention of the Allies overall on what we need to do working together with our partners in the region. Again, I mentioned the Mediterranean partners, but in addition, the so-called Istanbul Initiative partners, who are the Gulf states, they will help us, I think, to increasingly focus our attention in that southern region that is so critical to the security of Europe overall, because precisely of the problems you point to, the drug smuggling, the human smuggling, the flow of migrants fleeing from violence, war, and economic problems, poverty, lack of water, all of the problems that are emerging in those regions, across those regions of the world. So what we have really been focused on doing up to this point have been what I like to think about as really bread and butter efforts or very pragmatic efforts to make a difference. Here I refer to the operations that we've had in the Eastern Aegean, working together with the Greek and the Turkish Coast Guards in order to help to stem the flow of migrants in that area, but to make sure that those who are adrift in the sea are not abandoned to the elements and are left to perish. So helping those who are in those circumstances to survive the experience. It's also the case in the Central Mediterranean, working together with the EU once again, our Operation Sea Guardian and the European Operation Sophia, having the two to work together. To help to stem the flow of migration and make sure that, again, that it is taking place in as regulated a manner as possible. So we have been trying to be as pragmatic as possible. The other area where we have really placed a focus in working with our partners, and here I'll cite the work we've been doing in Jordan and Tunisia overall, is work on defense institution building and defense capacity building. So once again, NATO's particular role is to help the armed forces, the security forces in those countries to perform in a responsible way under proper oversight of civilian government leadership. And so we have a particular role to play once again in providing for that kind of defense institution and capacity building, and we will continue to do so. But again, in pragmatic ways, we are trying to help with particular problems that have come up for these countries. In some cases, for example, they are facing a great deal of unexploded ordnance from civil conflict that has been occurring in those areas. So we are trying to help train and help develop capacity in those countries so that they can clean up some of those vestiges, those horrible vestiges of civil conflict that have occurred. So we are doing everything we can across a broad front. I have to say once again, and I want to underscore once again, that NATO does not do everything. We have a certain toolkit that we work with, and we must, I think, continue really to develop our cooperation with the European Union so that we are complementing each other, so we are getting the best possible value out of the tools that we have available, and ensuring that what really needs to happen, that is the provision of economic development, the provision of more stability so that economic development can occur, jobs can be created, and that we can keep the populations really prospering where they are and not being forced into migratory patterns. These are, I think, strategic goals not only for NATO but for the European Union and for the individual countries who are working in that region as well. Certainly the United Nations, who is also very active in Northern Africa, very, very much share those goals. And by the way, the Secretary General just signed together with the Secretary General Guterres an updated joint declaration about a month ago that is enhancing our cooperation with the European Union, I'm sorry, with the United Nations. And a lot of that cooperative work will have to do with focusing on the South and being effective in working together with the United Nations on tackling some of these problems. So we will continue to do the best we can with what resources we have available. Our partner relations with Georgia and Ukraine, very important. In a couple of weeks' time, we will be gathering together at our foreign ministerial meeting again with the foreign ministers of Georgia and Ukraine. That, I think, will be an important moment once again to underscore the message that we conveyed at the July summit meeting in Brussels. That is that the Bucharest summit declaration of 10 years ago, from NATO's perspective, very much in force still, and that Ukraine and Georgia very much on the track to NATO membership. Both countries have more work to do. They need to continue to pursue the path of reform. And I don't want to group them together because they are at very, very different places in their development and in their reform processes. Georgia has made tremendous progress and is working very closely together with NATO. For example, through the so-called JTEC, the Joint Training Center in Tbilisi, that is helping very much on things like training and exercises and actually contributing in a very, very proactive and responsible way to developing exercise planning. So I would say Georgia's in a different place compared to with Ukraine, who have been fighting, sadly, been fighting an active war on their territory and have had to put quite a bit of attention into the capacity and capability of their armed forces. But nevertheless, we continue to encourage the Ukrainian government to proceed forward with the implementation of their national security law, and we'll continue to work with them very closely on the path of reforms as well. But I did want to underscore that NATO's door very much remains open. Talking about our work with Skopje, as I did in my address a few moments ago, the NATO accession process is very much in train there, with NATO accession negotiations ongoing. We expect them to conclude in early 2019. Again, the caveat is there that the two countries, both Athens and Skopje, must work together. And as I understand, we'll continue to work together. Skopje has some work to do in their parliaments, in their parliament, in order to ensure that the constitutional changes are made that will allow the Prespa agreement to come into full force. So with those caveats, I did want to underscore that NATO's door is open. The Belgian question on hybrid tactics, I want to talk about how, in fact, NATO is learning to respond very effectively to hybrid tactics. It's incumbent on all of us to recognize what is happening with the corrosive effects of disinformation in our countries, in our societies, but it is quite possible to push back and to push back effectively on these disinformation techniques. NATO does so from headquarters. We work very hard to make sure that we are getting out the facts about what NATO does, and not in any way to descend to the level of these propaganda claims, but to get the facts out and make it clear that what we are doing is supported by facts and information. We do so in a transparent manner. I just talked to a big group of Russian experts who were at NATO headquarters last week. Many of them are pretty influential in Russia in terms of talking heads in their media. But it's very important to be transparent about what NATO is doing. We had Russian media people come to the Trident Juncture to see on the ground what we're doing. So get the facts out. Don't be afraid about reaching out to the Russian media to get the facts out directly to them. But the other thing is, we need to be proactive about pushing back. I was just talking yesterday when I was talking to the Canadian media here in town about the way Latvia has been so effective in responding to disinformation regarding the presence of the battle group on Latvian territory and responding to the various attempts to portray, you know, the misbehavior of Canadian troops, Canada, of course, being the lead nation for that battle group, and how Latvia is very effectively pushed back against that, and Lithuania has done an excellent job as well in that regard. So I think we all need to be aware of what's going on, to recognize the disinformation, to be armed with facts to push back, and to be transparent, but to push back in an active way. And the media has a role here as well. It's very, very important, and Sec. Jens Stoltenberg always emphasizes this to media counterparts, saying, get to the bottom of this. You know, when you see something that doesn't look quite right, ask questions. Don't just accept it on face value. So the media has a responsibility as well in dealing with this kind of disinformation. But I am by no means hopeless about addressing these kinds of hybrid tactics in the disinformation sphere. And I want to finally give a shout-out to our Center of Excellence in Riga, Latvia. The Stratcom Center of Excellence has been doing some excellent work in terms of showing the way in pushing back against these kinds of techniques. Thank you.
Next three, Canada, Jane Cordy, Germany, Jürgen Hart, and European Parliament will be the next. Canada, Jane, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Madam President, and welcome to Halifax, Madam Deputy Secretary General. Yesterday at our Civil Dimensions of Security Committee, we had an excellent panel and an excellent discussion on women, peace, and security. And it reaffirmed that while we've made some progress, we've still got a long way to go. and discussions about the integration and inclusiveness of women in the peace and security agenda seem to have been going on for a long, long time. So in the 2017 annual report of the Secretary General, and I'll quote from it, NATO invests in incorporating gender perspectives into the analysis, planning, execution, assessment, and evaluation of NATO-led military missions and continues to deploy trained gender advisors to operations and missions at strategic, operational, and tactical levels. So going forward, I guess my question is, in what other ways does NATO plan to fulfill its objectives with regard to women, peace, and security? And secondly, do we have ways to measure the success of what programs are already in place and new, recently put in place initiatives that NATO has brought in? So how are we determining whether or not they are successful? Thank you.
Jürgen, Germany.
Jürgen Hart, Germany. I'd like to speak German. Madam Deputy Secretary General, thank you very much for your very clear and precise words. We very much appreciate this here within NATO PA, to be given precise information, and we know that you have a habit of doing this, and we very much appreciate this. From a German point of view, I would like to say that I fully endorse what you said in terms of burden sharing. This week in the German Parliament, the Bundestag, we will adopt our defense budget for 2019, which will see a 12.2 increase compared to 2018. I think compared with other NATO countries, this is close to the top in terms of increases. And this is a clear message that we take seriously the Wales decisions of 2014. I would like to ask you about the INF Treaty. You spoke about this. Our discussions here have shown that we all agree in our analysis that Russia is violating the treaty, and we also agree that we should take Russia to account when it comes to the INF Treaty. I thought it was very good that you said that NATO has to coordinate its approach here when it comes to implementing the INF Treaty. That's going to be an important point of the foreign ministers' meeting in early December, too. But what I believe, and I would like to ask you about this, the unilateral announcement by the American president to turn away from the INF Treaty is strategically not a wise step to take, because the fact that Russia has abandoned the treaty is one thing, but if we were to unilaterally abandon the treaty, this would not lead to a strategic advantage on our side. And I would like to hear your opinion on this, because I believe this is something that NATO countries should make quite clear to the American president.
European Parliament, David McAllister.
Thank you, Madam President, Deputy Secretary General. I would like to comment on the cooperation between NATO and the European Union you were just talking about a few minutes ago. As we speak, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, the EU's High Representative Federica Mogherini, and the EU foreign ministers are sitting together in Brussels to forge even closer ties between our organizations. And I guess we all agree that since the Warsaw Declaration and the adoption of the global strategy in the European Union, cooperation between NATO and EU has become more intense during the past 2 years. We have definitely made progress. However, I still believe that we could work even closer together, even more intensively in the future, because as we have heard this morning, complex threats need common answers. So the question is, Deputy Secretary General, the NATO summit in July took stock also of EU-NATO cooperation and issued a new joint declaration. What progress can you see in the cooperation between the two organizations since this summit in Brussels? And in your assessment, what are the benefits of this cooperation and where do you see further room for improvement? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some very good questions once again. I think I've joked to this body before. I always feel like I'm in front of a supercharged committee hearing in the U.S. Senate or the U.S. Congress. So, but thank you for all the variety of questions and the great interest that you give in supporting the work of NATO. First of all, on women, peace, and security, I'm very glad that you had a chance to speak with Claire Hutchinson yesterday. I thank Canada for putting forward Claire for the position of the Secretary General Special Representative on women, peace, and security. She is a fantastic ally in this effort and a very effective bureaucratic player within NATO as well, which is very important. She's very effective in the corridors of NATO. We have a long history of putting forward gender advisors for KFOR, gender advisors in Afghanistan. I think that history speaks for itself, but what Claire has done and what I've been very keen to ensure that we do is to refresh our policy in a way that will carry it effectively into the future. That is why I was so pleased that at the July summit meeting we were able to agree to a refresh of our policy with regard to women, peace, and security, and also agree to an action plan, a refreshed action plan going forward. And this has lent new impetus for all of our nations, but also our partners, the allies themselves, but also the partners have really been sitting up and taking notice on the WPS issues in recent time. I thank all of those countries around the room who have put a special emphasis on this matter. In addition to Canada, Iceland, Norway, the UK, I'm probably missing somebody, forgive me, the US is another, but I do want to say that it's good to have a number of allies pushing very, very hard on these issues. Oh, the Netherlands is another very good example. So we have some friends in this effort, and we are continuing to push hard to be more effective in this regard. What I would like to see, frankly, is more of what I again call these pragmatic projects. We just completed not very long ago the construction of so-called Women's Town in Afghanistan, which will enable women to train safely and with their families present safely for service in the police forces in Afghanistan. And they could not have done that if they did not have a safe and secure environment to live with their families while this training is going on. They couldn't be thrown in together with male recruits in the same dormitory areas, in the same living space. That perhaps can happen in our countries, but it cannot happen in a place like Afghanistan. So I was very, very glad that we were able to provide funding for this pragmatic enablement of further training for women to serve in the police forces of Afghanistan, because it's the women who are the ones who can go into the communities. They can get oftentimes to the heart of a matter that involves women victims, where a male would not be nearly so effective. So in order for security and stability to come to Afghanistan, we have to have women involved and trained and ready to work the issues and deal with the problems in the same way their male counterparts are so trained. So I think it's very important. I would like to see more of those kinds of pragmatic projects going forward. How to measure success. I hope Claire talked about this somewhat yesterday, but this is one of her main goals for the next year, because, Frank, quite honestly, we have not done enough in figuring out ways to adequately measure our accomplishment and our shortfalls. So Claire has got a big emphasis on this particular area for 2019, and I welcome that very much. I will do whatever I can to support her in her efforts to develop better measurement techniques so we can truly understand how effective we are being, and help our allies also as they're implementing their own national plans to understand what effectiveness means in this regard. The German question with regard to the INF Treaty, and thank you very much for your kind words addressed to me. The INF Treaty is, as I said in my remarks, something that has contributed to strategic stability here in Europe, and not only here in Europe, but on a global basis as well for now a number of decades, and it is a very important treaty. It is, however, a treaty that is only as important as the implementation of it occurring in a solid manner. And so I actually agree with SecDef Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, when he came to the Defense Ministerial in October and said, it is untenable for only one signatory of the treaty to be actually implementing the treaty. And the other significant signatory violating the treaty. It's untenable in that regard, and as I said in my remarks, I think it's not correct that only Russia should have ground launched intermediate range missiles. Now, who knows what the NATO response will be in this case, but NATO will take steps to defend itself. We do not foresee deploying intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe that are ground launched, and indeed there is no need for that. As I see it, the U.S. has very good sea launched and air launched capabilities that do not in any way violate the treaty. So the important thing is at this moment, I think, is to support the efforts to ensure, first of all, that Russia is taking this matter seriously. I was involved during the Obama administration in attempts to get Russia to pay attention to this matter. We pushed them from 2013 on. They would never even acknowledge the missile, but we raised it frequently throughout my time in office, and then the Trump administration picked it up. So it's been a true bipartisan effort, and we had a briefing team at NATO a week before last, and they laid out the diplomatic history for the entire NATO community, talking about the more than 30 meetings and diplomatic discussions that have taken place on this matter between the Obama and the Trump administration over the past 5 years. So a true bipartisan and I would say by-administration effort, both administrations involved in trying to make progress on this matter. But the Russians have simply stiff-armed us at every step of the way. And so now I think it is important that they be called to account. I do think it's important that we continue to focus on diplomatic efforts to call them to account, and that is definitely the effort that the Allies are undertaking now to make sure the Russians know this is serious, and also to do everything that we can to encourage them to get down to business at the diplomatic table. So I think that's the main point, and it is, I think, very important to continue to work together and to pull in the same direction on this matter. And there's been very good cooperation, not only the briefing teams that have come over from Washington. They provided very, very good information so that allies are more and more gathered around the notion that this is a very significant violation of the INF Treaty. But they've also, I think, contributed very well to the discussions among the allies on this matter. So the foreign ministerial coming up in a few weeks' time will be an important step along the road, but I, for one, continue to believe that it's possible for the Russians to come back into compliance with the treaty and to preserve this important treaty. The question from the European Parliament about where we stand on cooperation between NATO and the EU, we have indeed made progress. I agree with that, as I stated myself. And the joint declaration, the new one that the Secretary General signed with Presidents Tusk and Juncker during the summer, right before the summit meeting took place, has been an important additional impetus. So what progress? I can see significant progress in important areas that I think will carry us forward into more effective interaction. Right now, for example, there is a so-called parallel and coordinated exercise that the EU is sponsoring called PACE 2018, focusing on terrorist threats. This is something that is really important for NATO and EU to be able increasingly to understand each other's decision-making, to understand warning and how warning is treated in each case, to be ready to respond together in the case of terrorist attacks, for example. And this exercise is very much focused on terrorist, counter-terrorist actions. So I think that's a good example of how the fabric of the EU and the fabric of NATO are coming together more closely on issues such as crisis response and crisis decision making. So I would like to see more of that kind of close and difficult work going forward. Excuse me. It's not easy to bring together the procedures and the way of making decisions in two very different organizations, but that's the kind of really deep cooperation that we need to be doing more of, in my view.
Thanks. And now three more questions. First from Armenia, Korian Nahapetian, Georgia, Sofia Katsarava, and Ukraine, Irina Friz. Armenia, please.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Secretary General. As stated in Brussels Summit Declaration, NATO's partnerships will continue to be essential for the Alliance's work. In this regard, I have two interconnected questions. Many partner countries have individual partnership action plan and other toolkit of cooperation, particularly engagement in peacekeeping operations, in different interoperability initiatives, and so on, under the auspices of NATO. Within the general policy of NATO, what does the essential nature of the cooperation entail? And secondly, will it include new cooperation directions within partner nations in military and security domain? If so, what possible directions would you emphasize, including in frames of the security network with the European Union? Thank you.
Sofia, Georgia.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Secretary General. Thank you very much for your interesting and informative introduction and answers. And on behalf of the Georgian delegation, I would like to thank you for your personal engagement and support to Georgia's Euro-Atlantic integration. We highly value this. I would also like to thank our colleague from Lithuania, who in a way asked the question about Georgia and Ukraine, and I completely agree with you that the consistent messages about open door policy are extremely important for us. However, I would still like to ask a specific question on Georgia, particularly given that Georgia and NATO possess all the practical tools for preparations of Georgia for the membership, and we meet all the criteria on defense spending capabilities and contribution to shared Euro-Atlantic security, and Georgia is recognized as an exemplary aspirant nation. There is still no consensus built amongst the allied nations. And here, this morning, I was reading literally a few minutes ago, I read the statement by the former Secretary General saying that it was a mistake from the side of NATO for not granting map to Georgia and Ukraine, and it was a bad signal to Putin. So my question would be, considering all the above and the lessons learned from the recent past, what other concrete preconditions should be created to facilitate consensus-building process in the alliance? Thank you once again, and taking the opportunity to thank our Canadian colleagues for hosting us so warmly here. Thanks.
Irina Friz, Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam President, and thank you, Madam Deputy Secretary General. At this session, we discussed the issue of Russian private and military companies' activity. But I'd like to make a stress on the problems of the foreign mercenaries. those who fought in Syria as ISIS fighters and those who fought in Donbas. For example, hundreds of foreign fighters in the east of Ukraine. Some of them are specialized on sniper actions. We have all evidences of crimes, names, and place they came from. My question is, don't you think that we should pay more attention to the problem of mercenaries who participate in battles, have fighters' experience, and could be used by hostile forces in our countries?
Thank you. And first of all, I wanted to emphasize the degree to which I personally support and am delighted to see the presence of partners here also participating, and obviously with a great deal of sophistication, helping to focus the attention of the broader NATO community on some of the particular issues and dangers that you face in your country. I will just mention briefly my recent trip to Georgia as well, and having an opportunity to meet there with women who are trying to help to provide humanitarian assistance to the populations in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and the heroic role that they are playing, but also helped me to understand quite vividly some of the particular challenges for Georgia in dealing with that situation. And very, very much the same endorse Irina Fritz and her role the several times I've been to Kyiv recently, having an opportunity to meet with women there and to understand the challenges in the eastern Donbass. So I thank you all for helping to open our eyes to what the large challenges are of living in these areas where there are continuing conflicts going on. And turning now to Armenia, I had an excellent trip to Armenia a few months ago, about 6 months ago, and I want to underscore the degree to which Armenia has been a very good partner in the Caucasus region and has, again, been helpful to us in terms of understanding some of the particular challenges in that part of the world. But you ask an interesting question about the essential nature of partner cooperation. What does it entail? And it's, as you know very well, sir, it's a kind of multi-speed cooperation. Partners determine for themselves what speed they want the cooperation to be at and how intense they want it to be and what particular aspects they want to focus on in choosing from the menu of activities, the training activities, the other kinds of cooperative activities that NATO has on offer. So the IPAPs are very much, the individual partnership and cooperation plans are very much focused, programs are very much focused on what each partner wants to do, and NATO doesn't force any partner to do anything, but we look for what the particular interests are and what the particular needs are for particular partner countries. And in that regard, I think Armenia has been very good at developing a unique program that's suited to its particular needs. And I want to particularly endorse the way Armenia has worked together with Germany and with NATO to fulfill its responsibilities and commitments under the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, working to eliminate some vehicles that needed to be eliminated under that important treaty. Armenia did not have the resources available to do so, but Germany stepped forward, and in a very responsible way, Armenia was then in that way able to fulfill its commitments under CFE. And it's so important because CFE is yet another of those treaties that the Russians have treated in a very fast and loose way in 2007, seizing implementation of CFE in a way that was very questionable from a legal standpoint. So again, I endorse the responsible approach that Armenia has taken toward that treaty. On Georgia, yes, indeed, the Georgian acquisition of all practical tools in terms of being along the road to preparing for NATO membership, defense spending, it really, I agree, has been an exemplary nation. And you asked the question of what can best be done to work with the NATO allies on producing consensus. And I think my best answer to that is to do what you have been doing, and that is to consult very closely with NATO member states, to be constantly in contact with them, to be interacting with NATO member states, not only as Georgia does, working together with us on our important missions in Afghanistan, working with us to, as I mentioned, train, to prepare exercises, to train for exercises. Georgia has been of enormous importance to helping us develop cooperation in the Black Sea region, and particularly cooperation on training and exercises in the Black Sea region, increasingly becoming a focal point for Russian naval activities as well as air activities. So that military interaction is very important to the development of consensus over time. But also, it's very important to continue developing consultation and deep and intense interaction at the political level as well in order to develop that consensus over time. So I endorse what George has been doing so far and say that that keep at it. I know it's hard work, it's intense work, but nevertheless, I think Georgia is going about it in a very positive way. The Ukrainian representative asked about the role of mercenaries and shouldn't we be focusing more on that. My answer is a definitive yes. I want to say that Ukraine and NATO have recently agreed on a so-called counter-hybrid platform to study what has been going on in the eastern Donbass, what has been going on with the hybrid techniques that Russia has perpetrated in Ukraine, on Ukrainian territory. And so I very much think that this is a win-win situation for the alliance to be able to understand better the sophisticated evolution of these hybrid techniques that Russia is perpetrating. And frankly, I think the use of these mercenary and private military companies is an aspect of what we should be looking at in developing with Ukraine our agenda for the counter-hybrid platform. It's going to be very, very important, I think, for us to understand more fully, because we've watched what's going on in Ukraine. We've watched what's going on in Syria with, like, the Wagner Group and so forth. But I have to say, in terms of understanding what the potential implications may be for NATO, I think that discussion could be very, very useful. So, again, thank you to Ukraine for providing us with the mechanism through the counter-hybrid platform. This was agreed not so very long ago. Now we have to develop what the agenda will be, and this is an important topic. Thank you.
Next three, the USA, Gerald Connolly. Next, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, Vessel Memedi, and UK, Richard Benyon. Gerald, floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam President, and Madam Deputy Secretary General, thank you for being here and for your patience. I wanted to return to the High North or the Arctic. This body actually addressed security in the Arctic last year in what some described as a brilliant paper. I couldn't comment. But two things. It just as you said, NATO can't do everything. Neither can the Arctic Council. The Arctic Council does not provide collective security. Lots of other things, but not that. What we documented in that paper was the Russian military presence in the Arctic is expanding, like during the Cold War. And we, NATO, need to respond. We need to at least be upping our monitoring. And we called for an annual report on the security situation in the Arctic so that if other decisions need to be made, they can be. Is that report forthcoming? And if not, why not?
Vessel Memedi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Deputy Secretary General, we are really sorry for bombarding you with so many questions. And I thank you for your patience. In your presentation, you talked about differences of opinion among member allies, and you illustrated with two examples with regard to Iran treaty and the trade war. I would include two or three more with regard to reluctance of invoking Article 5 because of aggressive people of Montenegro, or unilateral decision on invading Iraq, and finally unilateral decision on INF treaty. Now, as a response to this, I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, we have a European army of 9 member states that are trying to create a European army. Now, we see that something is going on inside the alliance. So it looks like the attraction force is among these issues. And my question would be, Madam Deputy Secretary General, what would be the attraction force to pull us from this feedback loop that is going on for quite a while? What exactly would be that something that will bring us together, not to have so many differences of opinion, as you call it, or disagreement, because the alliance is facing huge challenges right now? Thank you very much.
The United Kingdom, Richard Bennion.
Thank you. The deterrent effect of NATO is all about its capability to deter an aggressor. And while it's welcome that many countries have increased their spending on defence, some of them are from a very low base. And it's, I hope you agree, it's really crucial that we stick to the Wales commitment of 2% and that we encourage all countries to achieve that. But in doing so, it's not how much money we spend, it's how we spend it. And you spoke very eloquently about a very good example of interoperability. But would you agree that there are problems of interoperability where people are purchasing defence equipment that bears no relation to how others in the alliance do? And for example, when one member of the alliance buys such items as air defence systems from Russia, does this not cause real problems in terms of that kind of interoperability that we so desire if we're to be an effective alliance?
The question about the High North, I will just say again, and it was very good this year that we had Trident Juncture in Norway, because it was a real wake-up call, I think, to many of the countries across the alliance for understanding the real challenges of operating in cold weather, and everything from ensuring that they had winter tires on their vehicles to ensuring that they had proper winter boots and proper winter clothing. For many of the allies, it was a very, very important step forward. We need to do more of that. There's no question about it. And for that reason, I really emphasized in my remarks the need not only to do more training and exercising in the region, but to acquire the equipment, the capabilities, indeed even the warm weather clothing that is needed. So allies will have to pay attention to that. I am going to have to take your question, sir, on the annual report on the security situation in the Arctic, whether the report is forthcoming. I know that we have regular now, our Joint Intelligence Division is regularly doing reports on this, but this particular report I am not aware of its provenance, so I'm going to have to check into it, and I'll have to get back to you with an answer to that. The question from our colleague from Skopje, you know, there are, again, differences of opinion among the allies, but I will just repeat again how important it is that we think about these as being disagreements among a single family. And even though families can have pretty fierce fights from time to time, the family is not pulled asunder. It is not pulled apart by fights. It basically remains the family no matter what. And in that regard, I want to stress that from my perspective, all these discussions about autonomy, strategic autonomy, European army, European military forces, for NATO, this can work, but it can work as long as such forces contribute to burden sharing inside NATO. And for that to work, three important conditions must be fulfilled. First of all, if forces are to be developed in the EU context or, as some of these discussions have been, a kind of separate European context with just a more informal conglomeration of countries involved, such forces must be also made available for NATO missions and operations. They must be resources that NATO also can draw on. Second important condition is that we can't have two competing and battling requirements processes. Each, the European countries and EU itself, NATO, we have procedures in train to develop the requirements to acquire capabilities. Those requirements cannot be clashing so that EU and many EU nations are also NATO nations. They cannot be pulled in two directions by competing requirements. So that's the second important condition. They must be complementary. That requires very, very good, I think, transparency and communication between the EU and NATO on the important requirements issue. And by the way, to our European Parliament colleague, that's another important area, I think, to continue to develop good transparency and communication in the requirements arena. Some of that is quite technical, so we really have to be speaking the same language also on requirements. And the third important matter is that the non-EU NATO allies must also be involved in the process, and there must be transparency for them. They must be able to participate in the process. So as long as those three conditions are fulfilled, I think that we shouldn't be afraid of Europe developing its own capabilities, but we have to be sure that we keep a sharp eye on those conditions and those conditions being fulfilled. Let's see, the question from the UK. With regard to the purchase of air defense capabilities from Russia, this concern has come up with the so-called S-400 purchase that Turkey has in train. And Sekcan and I and others in the NATO leadership, we've always been clear that it's up to nations to make their own decisions about what weapon systems they are going to buy in order to fulfill requirements. But from the NATO perspective, it is really important that those systems be interoperable. And this system is simply not interoperable with NATO systems, and it's difficult to see how it can be made interoperable. I, for one, was very, very glad when in January of this year, Turkey, also with France and Italy, signed an agreement to develop together and construct and deploy the so-called SAMT system, which is an air defense system that has been long in development and deployment. This will be a next phase in the development of this system. We welcome that very much, working and cooperating among allies to develop weapon systems. That's good for everybody. But it's that interoperability point that is the key one for the NATO alliance.
And now the last three in one group. Canada, Georgia, Netherlands. Canada, Cheryl Gallant, your floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Secretary General. During the course of our conference, we learned more about hyper warfare and that a 21st century war will be a war fought with autonomous systems. Is NATO considering a new NATO strategic concept to lay out a vision for the role of artificial intelligence in the alliance and to address the challenges of future war?
Georgi Kandelaki, Georgia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Deputy Secretary General, on October 29th of this year, Mr. Kosachev, who is one of the top foreign policy decision makers in Russia and chairs Foreign Affairs Committee of the Federation Council, stated that if one of the two candidates in Georgia's forthcoming runoff of the presidential election wins, there will be, quote, unpleasant consequences for internal political processes in Georgia. In Georgia, too, there have been similar voices saying that if one of the candidates wins, opposition candidate in this case, there may be a civil war. How would you comment to such voices who challenge the ability of citizens to alternate holders of democratic offices if they decide so? Thank you.
Netherlands, Franklin van Kappen.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, Deputy Secretary General, I would like to compliment you on the clear and concise way you answer all our questions. My question concerns the nuclear issue. If you read the Gerasimov Doctrine and all the security publications that are freely available from Russia, there is this disturbing message that they consider the use of tactical nuclear weapons as de-escalatory in certain scenarios. Now, this can be part of a very complex game of political messaging. My answer to you is, did we send a message in return? And what was that message? And if you don't want to answer that question in a clear and concise way, could you reflect on this issue?
Thank you. Again, very... very good questions. Many of them would be worth an entire seminar. The notion of hyper-warfare, where technology is taking us in terms of artificial intelligence. It's interesting, we just concluded the NATO Industry Forum last week in Berlin, and it was entirely swept up in discussing this set of issues. We also have, of course, our command, the ACT command in Norfolk that focuses day in, day out on innovation and the future of warfare, what we need to be thinking about in this regard. So the answer to your question is yes, we are thinking very hard about new technology, where it is taking us, where it is taking the future of warfare, first and foremost because we need to be mindful of what threats we are going to be facing in future, but second, in order to ensure that NATO also is on top of the new technologies and understanding what those new technologies, what kinds of capabilities those will bring. And I want to stress that NATO, as a defensive alliance, is always going to be looking at new technologies very much with how they continue to support and develop our role as a defensive alliance. We are not going to be looking, obviously, for new offensive capabilities that would contradict that basic fact, principle, and tenet of the alliance that we are a defensive alliance. I think it's very important that as the entire alliance, we think about these new technologies across the board. We need to be thinking about the normative superstructure that will form around them. How are we going to think about the utilization of autonomous weapon systems going forward? My own country, the United States of America, has long embraced a principle that is that decision-making with regard to autonomous platforms, autonomous weapon systems, must continue to contain a man, or as I like to say, a man or woman in the loop, that it is not the case that somehow, you know, robot systems should be allowed to operate without continuing involvement of human decision makers. Now, where is that going to go in future? I think we all need to reflect on these kinds of normative principles and think about the normative superstructure that will surround such systems going forward. So that's one important point. Another important point is to, again, consider what the relationship will be between the kinds of threats that are confronting us in this arena and where they emanate from. Indeed, the Russian Federation is putting a great deal of emphasis in this area, and but other adversaries, potential adversaries of the alliance, you know, it's the work on artificial intelligence and autonomous systems is widespread. So this is something we've also been very aware that you can confront in a kind of low-tech manner as well. One of the major projects we've had going on at NATO is to look at the way non-state actors, terrorists, extremists are taking off-the-shelf technologies like drones that they can buy, you know, off-the-shelf, and using them, modifying them slightly, both for their own surveillance purposes, but also for the delivery of weapons, small and sometimes larger weapons. So all of these issues we have to take into account. It's not only the large threats that may emanate from peer competitors, but also these capabilities in the hands of non-state actors and what that is going to bring to us in the threat environment. So this is a very complicated subject, but I did want to underscore that that NATO is focused on it. We don't have all the answers by any means, but we are focused on it and we'll continue to focus on it going forward. That was the key message coming out of the NATO Industry Forum last week in Berlin. Well, Mr. Kozachev can have his say, but from a NATO perspective, and I think from the perspective of all 29 democracies that make up the NATO alliance, it is simply untenable for outsiders to meddle in democratic processes and particularly in election processes. So that's my basic message here. Mr. Kozachev can have his say, but that's wrong. There cannot be that kind of interference from the outside in election processes. We are 29 democracies. Our partners are in the democratic space as well. We need to be underscoring that message constantly. And it's something the Secretary General says all the time. So I hope that Georgia feels supported in that regard. The Netherlands question. Yes, the question was with regard to tactical nuclear weapons and this notion that somehow in Russian doctrine they are portrayed in some settings as having a de-escalatory role. The core message from NATO, and I think from all of our capitals, with regard to the use of nuclear weapons, we continue to emphasize that any use of a weapon of mass destruction is morally reprehensible and is not in any way justified by battlefield uses or battlefield requirements, tactical requirements. So we, again, it's more on the normative plane. We need to continue to be consistent in conveying the message that nuclear weapons use, any nuclear weapons use, it doesn't matter, a tactical nuclear weapon, a strategic warhead, it doesn't matter, but any nuclear weapons use is reprehensible because, as Ronald Reagan himself used to like to say, my famous, well-known president, a nuclear war can never be won and should never be fought. So that's the top-line message that we need to continue to stress when these kinds of discussions come out in Russian military literature, for example, or in other military literature as well, that any use of a weapon of mass destruction is reprehensible, and where nuclear weapons are concerned, a nuclear war can never be won and should never be fought. So thank you very much for your attention today. I've enjoyed talking to you as always. I'm very glad to have this opportunity today, and we'll look forward to the next opportunity, believe me. It's always very good for me as well. Thank you.